Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast for people who care about the past and about thinking well in the present. For additional reading, links, and extended conversations connected to this episode, visit www.historicallythinking.org, where you can also subscribe and join the Historically Thinking Common Room on Substack. Year of meteors, brooding year. I would bind in words retrospective some of your deeds and signs. I would sing your contest for the 19th presidentiad. I would sing how an old man, tall, white hair, mounted the scaffold in Virginia. I was at hand. Silent, I stood with teeth shut close. I watched. I stood very near you, old man, when cool and indifferent, but trembling with age and your unhealed wounds, you mounted the scaffold. That was Walt Whitman from the 1871 edition of Leaves of Grass, and the 19th presidentiad to which he refers is the election of 1860. No election in the history of the United States can come close to being more confusing, tumultuous, and consequential than that election. Now Jonathan Earle seeks to disclose its mysteries to us. And in fact, in his new book, He Has the People, Abraham Lincoln and the Election of 1860, he reveals that the 1860 contest was even stranger than we might have imagined it to be. Jonathan Earle is Associate Professor of History at Louisiana State University, where he also serves as the Roger Hadfield Ogden Dean of the LSU Honors College. Jonathan Earle, welcome to Historically Thinking.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was thinking of the subtitle. It would be perhaps be more accurate to describe it as Murat Halstead and the Election of 1860. But I can imagine that an editor at Oxford, if that was proposed, would say, hell no.
Absolutely not.
And who is Murat Halstead? Because this is more than just about – much more than just about Abraham Lincoln. It's the entire cast of eccentric and incredible personalities of the 1860. And weaving them, binding them all together is the reportage of Murat Halstead. So
That's a great verb. I probably should have used it more. So great question. When one is seeking to kind of make understandable, comprehensible this election, it's good to have someone leading you by the hand through meetings and conventions and secret backroom dealings. And as it happens, we have that person. And he's not a stranger to those of us who study 19th century or even American history. He's kind of a common name. But he, as a young man, went to every single political convention of the election of 1860, and he claimed to have gone to every single major party convention until the end of his life in the early 20th century. I can't confirm that. But Murat Halstead was a Westerner. He was from Paddy's Run, Ohio. He attended post-secondary college, which is very unusual for a Westerner. For example, Abraham Lincoln didn't get past what we'd call junior high. And he was a acerbic, biting pioneer reporter, claimed to only print the truth and to be objective in his reporting. He was, of course, biased. He was a Republican and kind of a Seward Republican at that before the election started. But he kind of gave us a real tour de force, a tour of the United States in the campaign of 1860. And coincidentally, he, although Walt Whitman claims to have been at John Brown's execution in that wonderful poem that you started with, Murat Halstead actually was. He showed up there, reported on it for the Cincinnati Commercial, which was his paper. And then he also went to Washington during this very strange time where the Congress had yet to organize. They couldn't decide on a speaker for reasons we can talk about later. So he's actually there at key moment after key moment. So I just decided to let him be my muse, my tour guide for the entire narrative of the election.
Just to give even a sharper beat on this guy, he's a Cincinnati newspaperman for a Cincinnati
Correct.
Newspaper, and he's a Seward man in Cincinnati as the bastion of Salmon P. Chase. So I think we can understand he is, even as a Republican, he's against the grain of his local Republican machine. Would that be fair?
True, although we can talk about Salmon Chase. Salmon Chase could have done much more service to his own candidacy by locking down support in his own state. Chase was a guy who did not make everyone a friend in the course of his political career.
That is a good political epitaph for Salmon Chase. Yeah. But let's begin. Even though John Brown's the raid and the trial occur in 1859, 1860 is unintelligible without it. So in many ways, that begins 1860. So let's start with actually the trial and with John Brown's presence. Here is a man who is, even by the standards of the time, deeply eccentric. And yet his presence in the trial in the courtroom on the scaffold has Virginians who are predisposed to hate him, who see him as the would-have-been murderer of themselves and their families. They respect him, however. And that is it's a very interesting moment.
It really is. Great question. And I think if John Brown had died in the engine house at Harper's Ferry of his wounds, he suffered some pretty good cutlass wounds, we would be having an entirely different conversation. The fact that John Brown survived the raid and was given ample time by his jailer in Charlestown, Virginia, to answer letters, to receive visitors, and to prepare his persona for what he would be like at the trial, kind of confounding Northern expectations, Southern expectations, and giving this just deeply felt, rational speech during his trial. He won over many, many people. You mentioned Virginians. Henry Wise, the governor of Virginia, could say nothing but respect for him. Not his ads, not his actions, not his deeds, but his persona at trial. Transcendentalists in the North wrote hagiographically about John Brown, about how Emerson famously said that, you know, if he died by the gallows, he would make the gallows as holy as the cross. I mean, these are weird things to say about someone who's plotted an insurrection, murdered people, etc. And is a radical.
And so he conditions the entire discourse that follows, right? This is, we won't get into Lincoln's Cooper Union address as deeply as I or you would want to, but this is, in many ways, Lincoln is continually having to triangulate, to position himself, give himself space against John Brown's presence.
That's a great point. So Lincoln's actually doing a little bit of campaigning when he hears about John Brown's execution in December of 1859. And John Brown's raid happens, I mean, I know it happens in a different year, but it definitely happens during the campaign of 1860. And it's as if, kind of saying some op-eds I'm writing, it's like 9/11 happening before the election of 2000, not directly after, or the attack on Pearl Harbor happening before the election of 1940. It just scrambled the chessboard in a way, or threatened to. And I think everybody had to triangulate. Democrats had to triangulate, especially Democrats not among the fire eaters. Republicans, big trouble. They thought they were going to do a little bit of coasting toward the fall, and they all of a sudden had to defend themselves against being an abolitionist or a terrorist on the one hand, and also accept the fact that, and Lincoln was very good at this, that the goals of John Brown are very similar to the goals of the Republican Party, stopping slavery, at least its advance if you're a Republican.
So there's John Brown. There's that crisis. And then there's another crisis, this is not my period, but I studied with Daniel Walker Howe and Richard Carradine, so it kind of became my period, whether I liked it to or not. But I have to say,
19th century by osmosis.
Despite learning things that Lincoln owned a German language newspaper, I remember Carradine telling me that. It was like, why is a Welshman telling me that? Why am I learning this from a Welshman for the first time? But I was not aware of the crisis over the election of the Speaker of the House, which is one of those things which you can see in retrospect was absolutely pivotal at the moment, but is completely forgotten. And yet again, you can't understand what happens afterwards in the election without understanding this. So take your time to dwell on this.
I love it. Well, one thing that's in common between your period, Al, and mine is that elections and inauguration of congressmen is a long space apart. It just, you know, there's lots of accommodating people for travel and making arrangements for rooming houses in Washington. So anyway, we have a period where the Republicans have done very well in the election of 1858. But a year later, these guys are still not seated. So what is kind of routine for most Congresses, I mean, I'll guarantee you, on January 6th, 2027, either Hakeem Jeffries or Mike Johnson is going to be elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in about 15 minutes after they gavel in the session. It is not in any doubt. Before the election of 1860, it took 3 months to select a Speaker of the House. And it's because of one controversy. It's because of a book. And here we are in an era where I'm worried that no one reads books anymore, or at least fewer and fewer of us read books. But a North Carolina author named Hinton Rowan Helper published, self-published, a book about slavery in the South, trying to prove with statistics, numbers, that slavery is impoverishing the Southern states, not enriching it, and increasing economic inequality in the South, not narrowing it. And it came out and it kind of didn't make a huge splash. Republicans liked it because that's kind of proving their point that what the states of the West should be are free states and have free labor. And let's confine slavery where it exists and let it slowly die out like Helper's tables suggest that it is doing. But what ended up happening was some publishers and printers decided to kind of excerpt it, do a Reader's Digest version of Hinton Rowan Helper's book, The Impending Crisis of the South. And a lot of Republican congressmen signed their names to it, whether they read the book or not. And it became a litmus test for acceptability in the new House of Representatives, whether or not you had signed off on this book. Southerners hated this book. They wanted this book to go away. They wanted Hinton Rowan Helper's name to disappear from the face of the earth. And one Ohio congressman, here we're looping back to Ohio again, John Sherman, related brother, you know, brother of the general, I believe the same guy as the Sherman Antitrust Act that's going way into the 1890s.
Yep. And he's basically, he's not going to leave American politics for the next half a century.
He's there for a long time. But John Sherman had signed on to this compendium of the Helper's book, and it made him unacceptable to a lot of Democrats and moderate Republicans. So he could not quite get that majority, even though Republicans had more seats than any other party in the Congress.
So moderate Republicans are upset by this? Why and what's a moderate Republican then? And
I think it's not as clear cut as that. Yeah, so there are enough kind of what they would call moderate Republicans who just didn't want to have anything to do with this controversy. So John Sherman, I think there are 89 votes where no candidate wins a clear majority of the congressmen in the House of Representatives. And actually, Murat Halstead is there for some of these debates and sees them playing out and sees how dysfunctional at least congressional Republicans appear at the beginning of 1860, unable to even organize the House, get themselves paid, create committees. The fundamental basic acts of a new House term.
But is this the first time since, I don't know, in a decade that secession becomes a threat? Because secession is being threatened if John Sherman, radical, is made Speaker by Southern congressmen, but Southern politicians more generally.
Is it the first time secession is dangled? I do not think so. It is the first time it is seriously contemplated by non-fire-eating radicals. And I do think this is going to be a leitmotif of our conversation is part of the American electorate, a significant part, says from the beginning that they're not willing to serve in a country, to stay in a country that has John Sherman as Speaker of the House, William Seward as President of the United States. And it gets the crescendo builds and builds and builds through the year.
So this brings up your first chapter is called The Electoral Chessboard. And to understand the electoral chessboard, we kind of have to know how politics actually works, how even voting works. We've just described what seems mad to us. People complain all the time the length of time between, say, the election in November and when a president is inaugurated in January and how long it takes and compare this to England and all the rest of that stuff. But they have no conception of what it's like in the 19th century republic. Things take, if this is slow now, it's glacial at that period. So you're doing everything almost at remove. Everything takes so long to achieve. So how does the actual election work for president?
It's a great question. So first you have nominating conventions for all the parties. And these, since the beginning caucuses in the early 19th century, they've gotten pretty routine in American politics. You know, a party will gather usually in a state between North and South. Baltimore is a favorite location for parties' nominating conventions, be they Whig, Jacksonian, whatever.
Not surprisingly, the first city with big hotels. So it's a good convention.
Absolutely.
City.
It still is. I'm a Maryland native, so I got a shout out to Balmer, Charm City. So after you have a convention, you name a ticket and a candidate. There's a platform, and then surrogate politicians, not the candidates themselves, you know, go out on the hustings and drum up support. A little bit of money is raised to start newspapers or to print campaign biographies of the candidates. They're usually kind of dashed off very quickly and don't make a lot of difference in the election. That changes, I think, in 1860. And then Americans show up on election day and pick up a pre-printed ballot from either the Whig Party or the Constitutional Union Party or the Democratic Party, whatever have you, and you drop it into a ballot box. It's counted very quickly. Sometimes people don't believe me when I say that, you know, Mariah Halstead knew who won the election of 1860 the night of the election. They didn't have to wait for California to count the mail-in votes, all these things that you hear people complain about in 2026. And then after November, there is a nice long, as you mentioned, 5 months where things get kind of finished up in the Congress, and the president, I assume, comes to Washington and takes the oath of office on March the 4th of the next year.
So very interesting. Conventions are a new political technology. Even they were about 30 years old by 1860, right? They haven't happened for that long. And it has a lot to do with, I was joking about it, but it has a lot to do with hotel rooms. The ability to have a convention means you have to have hotel rooms. So you have to have a modern hotel in order to have good
conventions. You have to have a hall that's big enough to hold all the delegates, or a balcony that's big enough to hold the women who like to attend these things too. But you can't, of course, have women on the floor of a political convention getting their shoes all full of tobacco juice and what have you.
Yeah, the second is the telegraph, because those votes can be counted from so far away, because there is now, you can communicate at the speed of light. So that it was very different, say, like the 1812 election, the 1816 election, 1820. You couldn't do that then. So that's a second new wrinkle on things.
Right. One of my favorite anecdotes in the book, you'd have to look hard to get it, is congressmen in Washington waiting around the Capitol's telegraph, getting some fake news from Chicago, and they do not then know that Lincoln was the nominee. And so you get to see in a very real time how people deal with a counterfactual in history, that Seward is the nominee, not Lincoln. And some people are happy or some people are sad, but they got the real news later on that very same day.
And I guess the third thing, which is unprecedented in world history, is that by 1860, and someone's going to correct me, probably in Virginia this is not the case, but every white man can vote. There's no franchise only for property owners. So this is a massive electorate. There is no electorate like it, I think we can say, in the world, quite as large.
It is the broadest electorate in the history of humanity.
I just checked. England won't. This won't happen until 1919 in Britain, when all men get the vote at the same time as certain women get the vote. So this is also, and this creates certain pressures, as we shall see, on the system. The fact that young men can vote.
Everybody can vote if you're an adult male. And South Carolina is the big outlier. South Carolina does not have universal manhood suffrage, white manhood suffrage at this time. It's a bonkers place that we could talk about over the course of this hour.
South Carolina is always enjoyable to talk about. And this will change. Virginia takes the vote back from white men in the Constitution of 1902. So this changes. But this is the electoral chessboard. And what we're also is clear, even before the conventions, is that the Democratic Party, like any party that's had immense political success over an entire generation, even two generations, the Democratic Party is tired. All American parties are always coalitions. Coalitions always take work to keep together. And eventually, if a thing cannot go on forever, it will stop. And that's the situation the Democratic Party is in 1860.
Yeah, I mean, the Democratic Party is one of the most successful political parties on the planet. It really has had tremendous success both in the legislature and in the presidency. It is a true national institution, south, north, east, west. You've seen all those great pictures of the levee at Andrew Jackson's inauguration. It's a powerful party. But yes, by even 1858, there are some real problems. Again, you have a significant minority in the party who is willing to quit the country rather than submit to rule by someone in the opposite party. That's never good. You have a really corrupt presidential administration in the Buchanan administration. It would have been pretty easy to run against James Buchanan and his party, even though he wasn't on the ticket, just because of external issues besides slavery, it was not a very well-run administration. And they had had this long succession of Northern presidents with Southern principles who kept slaveholders happy, who kept anti-slavery petitions, you know, bottled up in committee, who in the case of Buchanan, actually put his thumb on the scale of Supreme Court justice in trying to rig the Dred Scott decision and make it a decision both by Southern appointed justices and a Northern justice from Pennsylvania. He's really not done anything to help. And then on top of all this, Al, there is Kansas. And Kansas is the political problem that ruins the Democratic Party. The party splits over a seemingly nonsensical issue over a territorial constitution for the territory of Kansas that was voted through in Lecompton, Kansas, a pro-slavery constitution that is completely anathema to the bona fide settlers in Kansas Territory. The only way to get this pro-slavery constitution through was to have massive electoral fraud. Missourians coming over the border to vote, burning ballot boxes, do-overs. It's just a mess. And you have, after the Lecompton Constitution gets submitted to Congress, Stephen A. Douglas, who is the front runner, the obvious next choice for a Northern Democratic presidential candidate, break with the Buchanan administration over the Lecompton Constitution in Kansas. So already you have a candidate, although he's from Illinois, who has great connections with lots of Southern politicians, all of a sudden be anathema to a lot of Southern Democrats.
And he's further, and that fight between these two Northern Democrats, Douglas and Buchanan, has already riven the Northern Democratic Party, right? This is one of the subtexts to the Lincoln-Douglas debates is that Douglas is really at war with Buchanan over who will be postmaster in Decatur, Illinois, or what have you.
Knockdown dragouts.
It doesn't even have patronage in his own state. And so fury is really concentrated between Douglas and Buchanan, in addition to all the factions of the Southerners as well.
Well, let me say something about Douglas. I mean, Douglas was also just an amazing political animal. He had great instincts. He was very smart. He had almost boundless energy. I don't think he ever realized how much Southern Democrats hated him, though. Huh. And that's a blind spot he had. He thought he could paper over differences. He thought he could get everyone to come around and agree that maybe popular sovereignty is the only solution for this, where we all kind of give a little and lose a little. But Southerners they just will do anything to keep him from being the Democratic nominee.
So while the Democrats are a coalition that's starting to splinter, the Republicans have the good problem of a coalition that's coming together. And Abraham Lincoln of Illinois is not the person that anyone thinks is going to climb aboard the top of that party apparatus. So who are they? We've already mentioned Salmon Chase. We've mentioned William Seward. Seward is the leader of the Republican Party. In 1858, if you asked anyone who's going to be the Republican president in 1860, it would have been Seward. So how does Lincoln climb aboard the chessboard?
Yeah. If there were prediction markets in 1858, Your Seward bet would get you nothing. Everyone agreed Seward
lost a lot of money.
He would have lost a lot of money. And I'll mention two. I mean, so definitely Salmon Chase was in every way, you know, he was always in the conversation. But again, he came from the Democratic Party originally, but he was really viewed as an anti-slavery, more radical than other parts of the country. Then you have this guy from St. Louis named Edward Bates, who Horace Greeley, the most powerful journalist in the country, really throws his weight behind as early as 1858, basically looking for electability. You know how we still do that in 2026? You know, some brilliant political consultants in Maine or New York decided that Graham Platner, this oyster farmer who has never been vetted, was electable in his Senate campaign against Susan Collins. So as far as electability, Edward Bates looked pretty good. He was a very, very, he's barely a Republican, former Whig, barely anti-slavery, but he's from a slave state. Horace Greeley thought he was the bee's knees. And then you have all these kind of second-tier folks. And Lincoln, I think, is the head of the second tier, is only mentioned in the literature that I've read, in the documents that I've read, as a potential vice presidential candidate before the Chicago nominating convention. I think Eric Foner and Don Fehrenbacher both use this term. He was everyone's second choice. He hadn't offended broad swaths of the party. He had made a good run for the Senate against Douglas in 1858, and that campaign was nationally covered in New York papers as well as Illinois papers. And Lincoln always cultivated an image as a Kentucky-born, you know, person with Southern relatives and a Southern wife, that he was more moderate on the slavery issue than people like Chase and Seward. I say in the book, I think that poor Seward gets tarred as being a radical far more than he was. And then just since you asked, and speaking of bad political consulting, Seward has all the best professionals lined up to back his campaign. He's got all the money. He's got Thurlow Weed, who's the most devious and brilliant political hack of the 19th century. Weed tells Seward to get out of the country during much of the John Brown winter and early spring of 1860. Just kind of absent yourself. And it had worked for Buchanan. Buchanan was actually minister at the court of St. James during the Pierce administration, was not even there for Kansas and the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So isn't it nice? You can waltz in and say, well, what did I miss? But Seward being gone for these kind of critical months as the speakership battle's happening, as the nation's chewing on John Brown, as things are changing by the minute, he's just not there. And he really kind of comes back and has to play catch up in a way that I don't think anybody on Seward's team expected to have to do. And then I'll close with this. Lincoln had this cadre, kind of local people. They're all from central Illinois, a couple of Chicago reporters. But
there are people from his circuit, right? There are people he trusts from when he wrote Circuit as a lawyer, yeah.
When he rides Circuit as a lawyer, he's traveled all around the state. And these guys turned out to be, you know, they were the James Carvilles of their day. They understood the electorate more than Seward's people in Albany and in New York. And they came to their convention in Chicago, which is the opposite of the Democrats' failed convention in Charleston. And on only three ballots, this dark horse candidate, Lincoln, wins a majority of the delegates. Now, Democrats can't win with a majority. Stephen Douglas gets every majority of every vote they took in Charleston. But in the Democratic Party, you have to get two-thirds of delegates to support you. An old holdover from trying to deny the nomination to Martin Van Buren in 1844.
It's around this. So let's talk about the Democratic Convention in Charleston. Yeah. It's around this time that James Pettigrew makes one of my favorite South Carolina comments, that South Carolina, too large, too small to be a republic, too large to be an insane asylum. So it is having
too large to be an insane asylum. It's so good.
It is having a political convention in the midst of the insane asylum. And that's actually what it was like. So could you describe it? And it's clear that the conventions of 1860s, they still haunt the imaginations of political journalists in 2026 who have never even read about them. But every year they go to conventions thinking that maybe it'll be like 1860. And I would say, after reading this book, you don't want it to be like 1860, but it's very entertaining to read about.
I'm glad. It's too much contingency, and especially for a political professional. I think I put in the book that deciding to hold the Democratic National Convention in Charleston was one of the biggest political blunders in American history. They could have chosen Baltimore. That's the go-to. Could have chosen Philadelphia. If you want to be on another, how about Cincinnati? The Queen City of the West would have been a great place to have a Democratic convention. No, they chose to go into the belly of the fire-eating beast, you know, the home of Robert Barnwell Rhett Jr. and the Charleston Mercury. And they should have known this was coming, because Murat Halstead, who's reporting, he does some of his best reporting on trains. I'm not sure whether these quotes aren't coming from him rather than people he says he's riding with. But, you know, he encounters these delegates, all of them passing around bottles of brown liquor, basically talking about how they're going to blow this thing up, not come out as a united party. And that is, on the eve of a convention, a recipe for disaster.
It's ballot very striking. It's something someone has said of the current political parties, that no one hates the Republican Party more than Republicans. And it's clear now, in the last wake of several of the recent elections, that no one hates the Democratic Party more than people being elected as Democratic representatives.
Yeah, that's so true.
And it's exactly the same thing as in 1860. These are I think it's a mark of coalitions in deep distress.
Yeah, that's right. And you're right that it's kind of played out. I like the way you described it in your question. And so Douglas is the obvious national candidate. He's the best chance for this party to win. But there are people in the Democratic coalition who don't necessarily want the Democratic Party to win. They want secession. They want a crisis. They want to kind of light that tinderbox and see what happens. So I think here's another way to put it. Stephen Douglas and his team thought that it was going to be a normal cycle, a normal convention, and it was anything but. And at kind of a preordained time, Southern delegates walked out of the convention, and literally these poor guys had to say, what do we do? Do we have to get two-thirds of the remaining delegates who didn't walk out? Is it just two-thirds of the party and we can kind of pace this all together? And they decide, I think it's a rational choice. Let's leave this crazy place, the insane asylum, and have a do-over in Baltimore in a few weeks and see what happens then. Kind of assuming that time may be a chance to heal some of these rifts that do not get healed.
1860 is not just a year for Democrats and Republicans. It's also now the Constitutional Union Party, which I believe the chapter is called, what is it, Fossils and Relics? Something like that?
Fossils, Mummies, and Relics.
Fossils, Mummies, and Relics. And so the Constitution Party is, if you looked at, say, the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, 1860, you would think it was the most powerful party in the land. But it is a party for people that just can't quit the Whig Party, even though the Whig Party is dead.
It is so true. They're all old Whigs, a lot of them Southern old Whigs, because most Northern Whigs, like Seward, like Lincoln, end up kind of gravitating to the Republican Party, if not in the summer of 1854, very soon thereafter. And, you know, if you read my friend Michael Fitzgibbon Holt's book about the 1860 election, which is very good, gosh, he's such a great researcher, you know, he gives these guys so much chance to win. And I'm also a big fan of historical contingency. There was a chance for a majority of the American electorate to, like, put unionism over political campaign, political platforms. But you're not going to do it by having these old guys be – they're not the future, they're the past.
So they meet in Baltimore, and they do what precisely? I guess it's a mark of their being fossils and mummies who they then nominate. There's no one fresh and young to put on the ticket.
No, there's not. They put John Bell, who's, again, very respectable politician, been held a lot of elected office, and then Edward Everett, who is one of the great orators of his day as a vice presidential nomination. So the Bell Everetts, as they're sometimes called, come out of a very quick convention. It's very well run. These guys could run a meeting as opposed to Democrats. They don't have the kind of participatory democracy problem. They're a top-down organization, and it's a fairly organized affair to nominate these two well-regarded national figures that I think plausibly, if you said, are these plausible president, vice president, Senate candidates? Yeah, they look plausible, but it's just against the grain of what the country is yearning for in 1860.
Then we've already referred to the Republican convention in Chicago. And speaking of another error, it was undoubtedly an error, a great error of Thurlow Weed to have the convention in Chicago, because David Davis, Lincoln's basically chief campaign manager and henchman, he is able to use all the advantages of being in their native Illinois to Lincoln's benefit.
He's the deciding vote to hold the election in Chicago. And again, taking favorites and also-rans out of the mix, it's a great idea to have your convention if you're the Republican Party in Chicago. It is
about
the fastest growing city. It's the city of the future. If you've read, you know, Bill Cronin's wonderful book describes the dynamism of Chicago so beautifully. And it just happens that Lincoln and Douglas are both from Illinois as well. And Lincoln has that kind of inside on some influential editors in both Springfield and downstate and Chicago. And Norman Judd turns out to be an amazing political fixer and negotiator, backroom negotiator. And the Lincoln team is up there making friends and shaking hands. And here's the other thing they're doing is they're offering promises. Lincoln always says that I never intended to be bound by any promises made by my guys in Chicago, but they made them. And then Seward's people show up on their train with their money, and they had the fancy hotel and they had better booze, but they hadn't slapped the backs and made the deals and cut the deals that the Lincoln folks had. So I would say it's chaotic, but it's organized. And I like the way you said it, Al, coming together as a party. And after Lincoln gets the nomination on the third ballot, most people are like, Yeah, it's a pretty good outcome.
It's a third, that third ballot. And we have to contrast that with, okay, on the opposite extreme would be Garfield's nomination. But third ballot, it is amazing that, and frankly, probably the least qualified man ever to be president, based on his resume, managed to do it one term
in the U.S. House.
And he was not he was not asked back by his constituents, as Alan Gwelter likes to point out.
That's right. The Whig Party of Illinois declined to renominate Abraham Lincoln for a second term, although he decided he wanted to stay.
Yeah, that's right. Poor guy. But there he is on the third ballot. Mm-hmm. It is really extraordinary.
Especially now that here in the 21st century, every political convention is made for television, and there's no drama who is going to be nominated once a major party convention takes place. I mean, unless you're counting 1968, which, again, no Democrat who's ever read about what happened in Chicago in 68 ever wants to repeat that. Just like Democrats should never want to repeat Charleston.
Exactly. But speaking of repeating things, so the Democrats get back together in Baltimore, but there's actually two conventions. Are there two conventions? Are there two different nomination from the beginning?
No. There's another very staged walkout of the Southern delegates, and they meet across town from each other. And you end up getting two Democratic nominees out of these Baltimore meetings. You have Stephen Douglas finally kind of, they figure out a way to change the rules and have Douglas be the nominee of the Democratic Party, really the Northern Democratic Party. And you have the sitting vice president be nominated by the Southern Democratic Party. So you have, and again, here's a guy who had plenty of political future, John Breckinridge, the youngest vice president, even younger than J.D. Vance, our current vice president. He's 36. He's handsome. He's tall. He's a planter. He's from Kentucky. I mean, this guy's a political comer. He tried. I mean, I'll give him credit. He really tried to not be the alternative candidate in the Democratic Party. He saw his future as maybe an 1864 or 1868 presidential candidate. And he wanted to kind of lay low because the Buchanan administration was so unpopular, so corrupt. He hadn't been personally tarred by that. But he's convinced by his Senate colleagues. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of senators in the news today because we've had a long-sitting senator pass away over the weekend suddenly. And all of a sudden, all the senators are giving these encomiums. Vice President Breckinridge was very much convinced by powerful senators from his party to consider this nomination and maybe just accept it. Jefferson Davis says at a dinner that people reported on, accept it to give it up later once we can unite behind a candidate, maybe Jefferson Davis, maybe someone else.
It's, can you dwell on that? Because I put a lot of marginal notes on these pages because it's the kind of magical thinking that's common in our own politics. It was common to a lot of people in the Republican Party in 2016. It was common to a lot of people in the Democratic Party in 2016.
I was going to say, just two years ago, we'll have a do-over because Joe Biden's so old. We'll just have like a what is Josh Marshall is one of my favorite political bloggers.
Something will happen.
Called it a Thunderdome.
Yeah, that's right.
So this idea, this magical thinking, we'll find the perfect candidate who will unite North and South, East and West. And let's talk about Jefferson Davis for a second, because Jefferson Davis
I was going to say that contrasting with Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis is obviously the most qualified man ever to become an American president. It just unfortunately was the Confederate States of America. His resume is – people used to say George H.W. Bush had the best resume of any president, but I think it's clear that Jefferson Davis does.
He's literally an amazing resume.
Every kind of box of personal experience, family connection, and military service – and political service. It's so he is logical, but he's the last person because, crazily enough, the fire eaters don't see him as radical enough. He's too moderate.
Again, and he had friends across the aisle. He's senator.
Which is bad. It's bad that across the aisle.
So I agree. So Jefferson Davis, of course, sees himself as a president as well, but he's smart, too smart to kind of throw himself into the mix too hard. And again, you're not... One thing I probably haven't discussed enough is running for president was so different 170 years ago. You can't pretend like you're really interested in this office. You're supposed to be called to the office. And of course, every one of these politicians we're talking about is burning with desire to be acclimated and be nominated and be elected and hold this office. I mean, there may be a few people who are legitimately not, but most of them just are dying for that kind of role. And Jefferson Davis is one of them.
Yeah. But at the same time, he doesn't want to look too eager. And so they come up with this thing. And so by the time this is all over, we've got, let me count, we've got John Bell, we've got Lincoln, we've got Breckinridge for this, basically the Southern Democrats. They don't call themselves that. Mm-hmm. But they, and then we've got Stephen Douglas. And there's this amazing, let me just read you to yourself. On Halstead's final journey from Richmond back home to Cincinnati, he reported sharing a railroad seat with a Northwestern Democratic delegate, a dyed-in-the-wool Douglas partisan. When Halstead queried the delegate about his sullen demeanor, the delegate responded that he was vexed. He continued, "After all the battles we have fought for the South, to be served in this manner, it is ungrateful and mean. According to Halstead, the man now wanted the South to be made to suffer under the boot of an abolition president. In fact, he was glad that Seward, whom he thought would be too easy on the South, was not the nominee of the newly ascended Republican Party, and he hoped that Lincoln would make the slaveholders sweat. After all, they've been ruling over enslaved African Americans so long that they thought they could rule white men just the same." I put in the margins, another future war Democrat.
That is a future war Democrat.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is like the conventions have radicalized everybody. Yeah. There's not
and
one
it might
person.
It might have just been Halstead. He said that, by the way, again. He's always talking. Because that also happens to be his view at that moment as well. But yes, I think there's a lot of rage among Democrats in 2026 that I think is underappreciated by pundits and some Republicans. And I think they're so too. Republicans in the North were ready to fight. And I'm going to use the words, the fight in quotes, because I don't think anyone's talking about putting on blue uniforms and gray uniforms the way that just 1 year later they would. But they really wanted a candidate who would stand up for Northern values and fight for them in a way that Buchanan never did and Pierce never did. And it was time to put these guys in their place. They feel themselves in the ascendancy, these Northern Republicans, and they see the South and the Democratic Party going the other direction.
So this is the era of mass participation by male voters. It's also therefore the era of mass demonstrations. So you have a great chapter on the Wide Awakes, which I've seen the pictures, but I didn't know much about them. So could you describe the phenomenon of the Wide? It's kind of a cultural marketing phenomenon. It's like it's another association in an era of associations.
It really is. And if you're interested in the Wide Awakes, I love John Grinspan's article in the JAH, and then he has a book about them as well. But I will say this. This is a group of young Republican supporters of Lincoln who start a little bit before that. They start being kind of a posse, a security detail for when a Republican speaker comes to a town, because there would be so much vitriol, some things would get thrown. There was a real danger that someone could be injured. So Cassius Clay, for example, the fiery Kentuckian, is coming to speak in Hartford. A bunch of these young men gather with torches, and since they have torches and the torches drip oil, they have these oilskin coats that they wear to kind of protect their clothing, and they start to drill and march as if they're kind of a paramilitary organization to, you know, kind of look cool, I suppose, cosplay being a soldier. Most of these guys were not soldiers at all, and they would follow the candidate from the train station to where the candidate is speaking that night. They'd probably have a couple cocktails, and they would march the candidate back. And this grows exponentially over the summer of 1860. So when Seward is a big surrogate for Lincoln, when Seward comes to New York, there are thousands of people. And then that's the illustration that you've probably seen in my book and so many others, of just a mass meeting of these militaristic-looking young men with their torches. And the point I try to make, because I really am trying to put myself in the heads of Northern voters as well as Southern voters. Southern voters see these engravings in Harper's and other national publications, and they say, "Holy crap! This is what happens if Lincoln wins. They're going to march just like John Brown. These guys are going to come straight into our homes, and they're going to tell us we can't have slaves. They're going to tell us we can't have a Democratic Party. They're going to tell us that they're in charge because they have the votes in the North. You don't have to have a single Southern electoral vote to win the White House in 1860.
They look like, to Southerners, not to put too fine a point on it, they look like the SS.
SS, they look like Proud Boys or those guys that were on the DC subway last weekend. You know, you could make the point they look a little silly too. You know, they smell bad. They don't really march in particular unison.
But it does look like that in Harper's. At Harper's, you see guys with capes, and I think they're wearing kepis. Everyone wants to dress like the French ever since Napoleon started winning victories. So they dress like French soldiers. They've got torches, and they're trained, they're disciplined, and they're ready to come south and take away your slaves and probably kill you in the process.
Take away your freedom.
Yep.
No, exactly. So yeah, it's easy to kind of imagine a torch turning into a rifle.
Yeah.
A Veacher's Bible.
This is there's a new book out. Just got the notice from UVA Press, a new book on the way that everyone was busily misperceiving each other in the newspapers of 1860. So, of course, Northerners look south and they see the Knights of the Golden Circle or whatever, mm-hmm. these other things. And they see the secret conspiracies of the South and of the slaveocracy, which have triumphed now with both Breckinridge and Douglas. They're both candidates of the slaveocracy. Never mind that Southerners hate Douglas, that for Northern Republicans, it's all their different fingers of the same hand.
That's exactly right. The conspiracy thinking is real. I used to teach a class in my previous life on conspiracy theories and paranoia in American history. And Lincoln's conspiracy theory about the slave power, you know, I actually think it's one of the very few true conspiracies in American history, but he's like, these guys are all having conversations about Dred Scott and about how to keep the gag rule going. It's really a terribly paranoid way of looking at people who you're supposed to be governing with. And Lincoln, of course, comes from the South. He's a Kentuckian. He identifies as a Kentuckian his entire life.
Yeah, this is Vernon Burton's point. This is Vernon's Lincoln is always a Southerner.
And certainly, I love Vernon, by the way.
Yeah, Lincoln does have Lincoln certainly does conceive of himself. He always is willing to provide the Southern point of view in any cabinet meeting. But it's another aspect of 1860 that we tend to, continues to exist more or less as a vestigial organ, like the Cossacks. It's the campaign biography. But in 1860, the campaign biography or autobiography is deeply important. Could you describe that and why?
So it is you know, the era of cheap mass printings, and you could get a campaign biography out about a candidate no one's ever heard of in a week or two. Lincoln's first biography that hits the street actually misspells his first name, which I always find amazing. Couldn't fact check that. But they're mostly true. There's a lot of cool anecdotes get thrown in there. Lincoln himself, though, is so, you know, he knew how important photography was. That's why he goes to Matthew Brady's studio before the Cooper Union address and dresses in a very non-Lincoln way to take a formal portrait. And he also writes a sketch about himself that kind of is the DNA of all the Lincoln campaign biographies. And it shows that, yes, he is a Southerner. He came up through the ranks. He was a Whig who loved Henry Clay. He's a moderate on all issues of the day. But he also also stands up for his beliefs, and he's not gonna bargain away the bedrock beliefs of the Republican Party. And so the zone is flooded with campaign biographies of Lincoln, much more effectively than the other candidates. John Bell says, here, you know what, instead of a campaign biography, why don't you guys just publish a compendium of all of my Senate speeches? No one's going to read that.
it's kind of a classic. It's interesting, isn't it? Because Bell is so old that he was there for Andrew Jackson and his campaign biographies. And that, of course, was the thing that made Whigs. That's what gave the Whigs their name. It's the detestation of the personalization rule in King Andrew. The fact that with no ideas, the man, occasional ideas wander into his head and back out like a Siberian in a blizzard.
I just want to mention the economics of this. These things sell. They're making these printers just boatloads of cash. And that's why you have really great, great authors. You know, Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote a campaign biography for his college roommate, Franklin Pierce.
It's a really good biography, by the way.
It's really good.
Really well written, of course.
So here you've got people who are great talents spending time writing these slipdash campaign biographies. And Lincoln is, they're just more about Lincoln, and Lincoln mania kind of spreads with these cheap, essentially free, but very lucrative for the producers biographies.
And yet no one's running a national campaign as we would think of it, except for Stephen Douglas. I think maybe it was Dan Howell who said that there's, You can detest all of Douglass's ideas and a lot of his personality, and yet the way that he ran the 1860 campaign, I think the only really word for it, think about it, is it's noble what he did. Because in some ways, he, at the bottom, he's actually an American patriot.
Yeah.
And I think there's some way in which it's the finest thing he ever did was to decide to go to the South, which is also insane. But damn it, he was going to do it because it was the right thing to do.
You do have to hand it to Stephen Douglass. Again, I think before that, there's very little evidence that he has any kind of political nobility in him.
Can confirm.
it's really hard to find it. I will say this, though. He came up with two innovative things because his back was against the wall. One was no one was gonna campaign for him the way he could campaign for himself. So he throws aside all of the decorum and all the rules of the day and personally campaigns for president in 1860. So he's a progenitor of our normal candidate going out there on the hustings. Now, even after Stephen Douglass, you know, I don't think William McKinley left his front porch in 1896. God, that's going way back.
Harding did in 1920.
So Douglass is out there. It's not a terrible strategy. And then he also, when he reads the tea leaves and he realizes that all of these fusion campaigns that are the last magical thinking hope of stopping Lincoln, he says, Lincoln will be the next president. I will go south to preserve the Union. And so he spends the last 8 weeks of the campaign going to places where he still gets a crowd showing up for him because he is a national figure. I don't want to say that that everybody hated him in the South. Southern Democrats who were in office tended to hate him. But then, you know, normal Georgians thought he was great. They'll show up and watch a 2-hour speech by Stephen Douglass. That's entertaining. He's a really good speaker, if he's not too drunk. But most of the time, he's a really good speaker.
And I guess we've talked in the past about, in a podcast, I'll put the link to it, about Southern Democrats who fought for the Union Army. And there are white Southern Democrats who do that. And they probably voted for Douglass or John Bell. But some of them did vote for Douglass.
Agreed.
And they become
a very small
percentage of them become the sort of war Democrats in the South.
Yeah.
And the electoral math,
and the nobility
though,
thing is true. Oh, yeah. Oh, please. No, I want to talk about the math. That's great.
Yeah, let's talk about the math, because at least as I recall going back to high school, as best as I can remember from being a C-minus student in that class, the math seems to be really inexorable, how the vote breaks down. Did it seem that way at the time? We're going to get to the inevitability question, but because I'm pretty sure that we could have a nice dinner if we put $5 for every time we read a book that said the election in the end was inevitable based on the electoral math. So can
you
respond to that?
I wrote this book. Yes, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because in every textbook that every AP US history kid reads, the election of 1860 is treated as inevitable. It's treated that, of course, Lincoln was going to get the nomination. Of course, the math backed the Republican Party. But there was so much contingency. There was so much chaos. And that's one of the reasons I really wanted to spend time write that error. Party professionals do understand the math more than most people because they watch how things shook out in 1856 when you have a brand new party and a neophyte candidate who's never given a campaign speech, who almost beats James Buchanan, who almost takes the White House in that party's first election. And, you know, Buchanan won Pennsylvania because he's Pennsylvanian, and he won Indiana because Indiana's pretty conservative. But you could see just flipping one, two of the right states, you don't need to win to do a national campaign. You just have to get all the northern states. Now, Democrats had a much more, I think, looking backward view. Like, all we have to do is nominate a popular candidate that has national appeal and we're going to win, just like Pierce won, just like Buchanan won, just like Zachary Taylor won. Not a Democrat, but like you can still not imagine for a lot of Americans that a candidate would be purely sectional. You know, Jefferson was not purely sectional. Adams was. That's why he lost. So they kind of had this magical thinking that the world hadn't changed. And then you just have so much immigration, Al, over the course of the late 1840s and 1850s. And most of it has gone to the northern ports. New Orleans is still the second largest city, I think, in the country, maybe third, because there are still – and I live in New Orleans part of my time. And, you know, I thank God for the Italian immigrants from the 1850s for inventing things like the muffalata sandwich, one of my favorite sandwiches. But so most immigrants are coming to the north. Most of the refugees from the German civil wars are coming to the North, and you're just getting more and more Americans identify as Northerners in 1860 than there were in 1856. So the math was not inevitable, but you had to kind of run the table though to win with just Northern states.
What state was Lincoln afraid that he would lose and thereby put his nomination in jeopardy?
So he was concerned about Illinois and Indiana, or his most two, and Pennsylvania spooked him as well, though Pennsylvania did not turn out to be that close.
And why was he worried about Illinois, about his own state? And surely that was why he was nominated.
He lost 2 years earlier in the race for the state legislature that chooses the U.S. Senator. Illinois was really a 50-50 state when Lincoln ran this campaign. It didn't end up that way on November 6th of 1860, but his most recent experiences were like running from behind in Illinois. And the southern counties of Illinois are still very much identified with Kentucky, southern Indiana, Missouri. They're much more like Missouri than Chicago, quite frankly. So one thing that I don't know if it made it into the final draft because I fought about it. They called the battleground states in 1860 doubtful states. I love that, you know, before the Civil War, before our very war-torn 20th century, it's kind of a quaint religious metaphor instead of a martial one. Mm-hmm. So these doubtful states are where Lincoln pours his energy in the summer and the fall of 1860.
And that's why he owns that German newspaper. He needs to get the German vote in Northern Illinois out. Everyone must vote.
Exactly. So especially German Protestants, and there are a lot more German Protestants coming into places like Illinois, Indiana, Pennsylvania after the failed revolutions of 1848. That's where you get Carl Schurz, you know, coming to the United States, future Civil War hero. And Lincoln gets it. One of the things you've got to give Lincoln credit for is he saw that the future of the Republican Party was an anti-slavery party, not an anti-immigrant party. Lots of Republicans came out of the Know-Nothing tradition. William Seward came out of the Know-Nothing tradition. That I think very few Germans, even German Protestants, were excited to vote for people who had come out of that anti-immigrant, know-nothing American Party tradition. And Lincoln never was that.
If Douglas had taken Illinois and Indiana, what would have happened? How would that have tilted things?
It would have tilted things. I actually have a long chapter at the end that details like how the ways that each candidate could have made a run at it. Douglas's math was really, really bad, but he could have flipped a lot of those states, and he did. You know, you mentioned that he ran the only national campaign, he was the only candidate that had support in North and South and East and West. He is it, unless you count, you know, different counties of Kentucky as North and South, which I don't. But I think it's very plausible that he could have won Illinois and Indiana and Pennsylvania, and some of these fusion tickets in New York could have thrown the election into the House of Representatives, which had happened before and had elected John Quincy Adams came out of that contested election in 1824, having not won the popular vote, having not won the electoral vote, but ended up being the choice for president. And I think there was a real chance that if you took New York off the table, if you took Pennsylvania off the table, you could have thrown things into the House. And as we know, because every 4 years we have this weird conversation where each state gets one vote. Their congressional delegation selects who the state will vote for. And you could see how if everybody united against Lincoln, they could have stopped it if it was thrown into the House of Representatives. But again, like, you know, if you have the pool analogy, you have to run the table for that to happen.
So your answer to already my last question, though, is that there is nothing in the end, there's nothing inevitable about the election of 1860. Because
correct. There's so much contingency. There's so many candidates. There's so much crazy stuff happening from you know, coming in externally, like John Brown, like the failures in the House of Representatives, surprise dark horse candidates. And also, I'm going to give the Fire Eaters a lot of credit. They bide their time. They don't quit the party before the election. They stay in the Democratic coalition and then kind of sabotage the party and then the country from the inside. I mean, you know, if you could imagine a heroic tale, and again, I think these were the worst people on the planet, but, you know, Wigfall and Yancey are playing this whole election cycle perfectly if you want the country to blow up. And it was, and it's hard to imagine it blowing up in 1856 or 1852. Yeah, there's a political crisis, but we've had those.
One last thing. There's that 4 months between the election and the inauguration. And in it, of course, all of the southern states, with the exception of the Upper South, secede. And then everything is completely different, such that Douglas, in the last months of his life, is probably Lincoln's best ally in Washington. What did Lincoln do right or wrong in those months? This is where it becomes, for Lincoln, the constitutionalist who sees himself as the sort of heir, son of the founders. He's not joking when he says that this is the question of whether democracy and self-government can endure upon the face of the earth, right? This is where union becomes a sacred cause and briefly eclipses slavery. I think am I wrong about that? Because
if we had a poll from that time, yes, I think you would be right. Because it is a real political crisis. Well, let me just start with some of our predecessors in the historical profession. Everybody agreed for many, many years in the 20th century that Lincoln failed in the period between his election and his inauguration, that he made terrible mistakes, that he didn't take seriously the fire eaters and secession movement, and he thought things would kind of get papered over at the last minute. I actually want to forgive Lincoln for a lot of this. There's not much a guy based in Springfield, Illinois, staffing up an administration can do, you know, when the fire eaters are bringing the house down like they did with the conventions in Montgomery and the creation of the Confederate States of America and this cornerstone speech. What I think Lincoln did right was he kind of kept the temperature as low as he could. He made very good cabinet appointments. That's why Doris Kearns Goodwin has a great beach house. She explained that very well. And he also refused to budge on the central issue of the election, because all of these compromise efforts, the Crittenden Compromise, the constitutional amendments that are working their way through both houses of Congress, they all required the president to give up the fundamental reason he won the election of 1860. Say, let's just extend the Missouri Compromise line all the way across the country to California. That'll be a way to salvage our country. And Lincoln ultimately said, despite his constitutional, you know, background, his deep-seated unionism, he said, no, that's not what the voters are sending me to Washington to do. So the answer is respectfully no. And I have this part in the last, you know, people know about this in our profession, but I don't think the general readership knows that there was a 13th Amendment that would have enshrined slavery in the U.S. Constitution without the ability to ever remove it. I don't know how you could do that, what the language would be like. No do-overs for this amendment ever.
Yeah.
And Lincoln, you know, basically shut that movement down. And he could have given it oxygen, and he shut it down. And I also think that maneuvering over Sumter, which is, again, a Civil War book, was brilliant. He made the South fire the first shots. He made the Civil War be one of putting down a rebellion in a way that I think helped him later.
My guest today has been Jonathan Earle. He is the author of He Has the People, Abraham Lincoln and the Election of 1860, which for political junkies is perhaps the best beach read you can have this summer. Jonathan, thanks for being part of Historically Thinking.
Happy to be part of this conversation. It was great.
Thanks for listening to Historically Thinking. If you value serious conversations about the past, conversations that resist easy answers and quick moralizing, you'll find more essays, links, and extended discussions at www.historicallythinking.org. You can also join the Historically Thinking Common Room on Substack, where supporters help sustain the podcast and receive additional material designed to deepen their historical understanding. Share the podcast with others who care about history, subscribe wherever you listen, and most importantly, keep thinking historically. I'm Al Zambone. I'll talk to you next week.